When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Tonight on The Readout.
This is what took me off and takes me off the campaign trail, because I should be in Georgia now. I should be in Florida now. I should be in a lot of different places right now campaigning, and I'm sitting here. And this will go on for a long time. It's very unfair.
Very unfair. Donald Trump goes on trial as opening statements and testimony begin in the Manhattan courthouse. We will break down what the jury of 12 Manhattanites heard and what Trump, the Republican Party, and the country face going forward. Plus, chaos at Columbia, the battle for America's elite institutions, boils over at one of New York's Ivy League universities, with charges of anti-Semitism and suppression of free speech flying back and forth, and the school calling the cops on their own students. But we begin tonight with the historic first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president, which was almost not the first. In fact, the world seemed to stop on its hinges on August 8, 1974, as America's 37th president, Richard Nixon, became the first U.S. president to resign before the end of his term.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Nixon resigned because he had committed crimes, misusing government agencies, including the FBI, the CIA, and the IRS, to cover up the burglary of the Democratic National Committee by his hired goons. The motive? To ensure his reelection. Nixon was reelected, but halfway through his second term, the scandal known as Watergate erupted, transfixing the public as it played out on broadcast television. In the end, more than 40 Nixon co-conspirators inside and outside the administration, including White House staff, his White House counsel, and the Attorney General of the United States, would be indicted or go to prison. But Nixon himself would avoid prison due to a decision by his successor, Gerald Ford, who issued a full pardon.
Now, therefore, I, Gerald R. Ford, President of the United States, pursuant to the pardon power conferred upon me by Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution, have granted and by these presents do grant a full, free, and absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon.
And while Nixon would, for the rest of his life, deny having been a crook, he knew, and we knew, that but for his resignation, he would have been indicted. The men and women who investigated Nixon have said as much, including on this show. And so Nixon was the closest America ever came to seeing a U.S. president or former president criminally indicted. Until now. This morning, opening statements began in the New York criminal trial of Donald J. Trump, America's 45th president, and the current Republican nominee to be president again. At issue, did Trump, like Nixon, try to cheat to win the presidency, in his case, by paying off women he had conducted extramarital affairs with decades earlier in order to keep them quiet and keep the information from voters? And did he drag his then lawyer, Michael Cohen, and David Pecker, then publisher of the National Enquirer tabloid, into the scheme? The way the committee to reelect President Nixon, which literally was called Creep, dragged in the Watergate burglars. Trump faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records for reimbursement payments he made to Michael Cohen, including checks handed to Cohen inside the Oval Office. He has pleaded not guilty, and his fate will be decided by 12 Manhattan jurors. The prosecution began this morning by setting up for those jurors what they should expect to see and hear over the next number of weeks for what the prosecution is calling a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up to conceal election fraud. That counter to Trump's claims to the contrary, he was intimately aware of and involved in the coordination of the hush money payment to Stormy Daniels to silence her story in an attempt to bolster his chances in the 2016 election. Now, remember, the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, who was in the courtroom today, laid out the case just over a year ago when announcing Trump's indictment, writing, from August 2015 to December 2017, the defendant orchestrated a scheme with others to influence the 2016 presidential election by identifying and purchasing negative information about him to suppress its publication and benefit the defendant's electoral prospects. In order to execute the unlawful scheme, the participants violated election laws and made and caused false entries in the business records of various entities in New York. The participants also took steps that mischaracterized, for tax purposes, the true nature of the payments made in furtherance of the scheme. The prosecution says that they will be able to show Trump's involvement beyond just the testimony of Michael Cohen, whose credibility the Trump defense plans to put on trial, through other witnesses as well as documentary evidence. That process began with the first witness called, former publisher of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, and we'll get to that testimony in just a bit. As for Trump's defense, they tried to claim that while Trump in some ways is larger than life, he's also just an ordinary man, a husband and father, who was just worried about shielding his family from the embarrassment of Daniel's claims that they had a sexual encounter just months after Trump's third wife, Melania, gave birth to his fifth child, a claim Trump denies. The defense claims Trump was not involved in any way with Cohen's payment, the reimbursement checks being generated, or the entry in his company's business ledger. It was someone else's doing. They told the jury that non-disclosure agreements are used all the time and are perfectly legal. And in Trump's overused playbook, his lawyers claim that even if he did try to influence an election, there's nothing wrong with it. It's called democracy. Of course, that will be what the 12-member jury will ultimately have to decide. Joining me now is MSNBC reporter Adam Reese, who was at the courthouse today. Danny Savalos, criminal defense attorney and MSNBC legal analyst. And Jill Winebanks, former assistant Watergate special prosecutor and MSNBC contributor. And while I cannot and refuse still to believe that you were old enough to be involved in the Nixon investigation, Jill, I wanted to have you here because I just wanted you to please reflect on the fact that we are now having what didn't happen in the case that you investigated with Nixon, the prosecution of a former president in this case.
I have two things to say about that, Joy. One, I fought very hard to make sure that Richard Nixon got indicted while he was a sitting president, because I do not believe that the Office of Legal Counsel opinion is correct. But I fought even harder to make sure he was indicted as soon as he resigned and was an ordinary president, not the sitting president. If we had succeeded at that, we wouldn't be having all this angst about what is going on now. It would have been shown that the country can survive an indictment and conviction of a former president. But the other thing I want to say is that we have to learn to say the right words. This is not a hush money trial. Mm-hmm. There was hush money in Watergate, and the hush money in Watergate was illegal because it was part of an obstruction of justice. It was to keep defendants from telling who had hired them at the White House and at the campaign. Here, the hush money was not illegal, but the cover-up of it was. The use of it to avoid taxes, the use of it to avoid Americans knowing before they voted what had happened. So I just want us to be calling this an election interference trial. That's what it is. There was hush money in both, but they were very different.
And I'm so glad that you said that, because I have been calling it, Danny, the hush money election interference case, because I think that's what it is. The hush money was toward another goal. Talk about the way the opening argument on the part of the prosecution has to make that case, because it's true. Having someone sign an NDA because you bought their life rights isn't illegal. They have to prove that there's a crime.
The prosecution essentially has to prove two major things. Number one, that Trump falsely was involved in the making of these false entries in documents and business records, but also that the intent was to influence the election. And that's why in opening statements, the defense somewhat surprised me. And maybe it's a little taken out of context, but the idea that they would come out and say, hey, there's nothing wrong with wanting to influence an election, that's called democracy. I thought that, to me, that's exactly the kind of thing that the prosecution will, in closing arguments, turn around and hit them over the head like it's a folding chair in their own closing. They'll say something like, you heard counsel tell you that it's okay to influence an election. That's the kind of thing that might come back to bite Trump, even if Blanche meant it in a different way. And maybe he was trying to thread a needle there.
And Blanche being the defense attorney.
Exactly right. Yeah. Trump's defense attorney. Mm-hmm. I thought that was risky. I also thought it was a little risky to come out of the gate and announce for the defense, my client is innocent. To a defense attorney, that seems like taking on a burden that you simply don't have to take on. We have no burden on the defense.
Right.
We need to prove nothing. In other words, oftentimes, and more often than I'd like to say, if you have a really tough case, your argument in closing is, well, essentially, they have a good case, but good isn't enough. They didn't get to beyond a reasonable doubt. When you come out and say, my client is innocent, you're essentially shifting the burden onto yourself. And maybe you'll see the people in their closing say, you know, defense counsel came out in their opening and he said, my client is innocent. Has he proven innocence? Does this look like an innocent man to you?
Yeah.
How'd I do? Does that sound like a good?
Yeah, it was well done. But I mean, this brings me to you, Adam, because when I read the Google Doc, where we were all sort of following along what was happening, those of us who weren't in court as you were, what I took from it, without even seeing Mr. Blanche, was that he is constrained to say the things Trump wants to hear, not to give the defense that he would probably give if he were free to give a defense of his own making. Even saying, you know, he's a family man. Well, where was his wife? If he's a family man and a father, there was no Melania there. There was no family there. But it felt like he was saying what Trump wanted him to say.
Right. He said, this is Mr. President. We're calling him that because he earned that. And there's nothing to look at here. Keep moving along. Things like he's just protecting his family. Michael Cohen really is out for revenge. He wants to see Mr. Trump in an orange jumpsuit. He's written about it. He's making money off of it. Stormy Daniels, for her part, yes, there may have been some communications, but there's never been any allegation that there was any sexual assault. She also is trying to extort him. And NDAs, everybody does NDAs. Rich people do NDAs. And this was not any type of an effort to corrupt the election. And even to influence the election, there's nothing wrong with that. That's what a democracy is all about.
Yeah. I mean, and Jill, it does feel, I mean, it is a conspiracy case. And I'm glad that you brought up the fact that it is, you know, it's not a Hushmanic case, it's a conspiracy case like the Nixon case. It's also a group of people who got together and committed crimes for someone else. In the case of the Watergate burglars, in the case of even the Attorney General of the United States, they committed the crimes, went to prison, but they did it for Nixon. They didn't do it for themselves. They didn't have any personal gain. In this case, Donald Trump is the only one who gained from this conspiracy. It's difficult for me to understand what the defense is if you say, yeah, all the things that you say he did, but there was nothing wrong with it.
It's incredible. And I've been a defense lawyer as well as a prosecutor. And I can say that overpromising is a really bad thing. And I think Danny was pointing that out. He's right. They overpromised by saying he's innocent. They could have rested on it's up to them to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and he didn't. And the evidence here is very clear. You have a very clear phone call. How are they going to rebut the words of Donald Trump talking to Michael Cohen, where he admits he knows what's going on? Let's pay in cash. And Michael Cohen goes, no.
Well, you called it up. Let me play it. Let me actually play what you're talking about. This is Michael Cohen. This is a 2016 recording. Now, remember, Michael Cohen gets a campaign website, a Trump campaign website, which he didn't have before. He's supposed to be his private lawyer. And this is a conversation they have as Donald Trump is running for president. This is Michael Cohen talking about buying the rights to Karen McDougal, the former Playboy Bunny story. Take a listen.
I need to open up a company for the transfer of all of that info regarding our friend David. I spoke to Alan about it when it comes time for the financing, which will be...
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to pay you.
So. Don't pay with cash.
No. I got... No.
still, I mean, they're going to try to impeach Michael Cohen, but Cohen, I'm sure, has more of that. He's on the phone with him saying, I need to do the thing that I'm accused of doing.
Well, not only that, one, he's pled guilty. Two, they have done a very skillful opening statement. And by calling David Pecker as the first witness, they are building the structure that will then lead to the supporting beams and the detailed interior. They have corroboration, much corroboration, for what Michael Cohen will eventually be called to tell. They also have two narrators. David Pecker is a narrator for this case, and he's laying out the scheme, the multiple times that they killed any bad evidence against Donald Trump, and that they promoted bad evidence against his opponents. So you have this, you know, it's like you're building a house and now you have the framework. Then you get to Michael Cohen and it's already been built up. So he sounds sensible and okay.
Right.
And then you have the documents and you can't rebut the documents. Donald Trump signed those checks. You have the tape recordings. Donald Trump said, oh, yeah, I know. Let's just use cash. No, 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 no. So I think that the defense really has its work cut out for it. One of the senior people on the Watergate case once said, you know, there are some cases that no one can win. There are some cases where you have to pound the table with the facts because you have the facts. Some where you have the law, you emphasize the law. And there are some where you don't have anything. And even Clarence Darrow couldn't win the case.
Yeah.
So I don't think Blanche is Clarence Darrow. And even if he was, this is not a case he's going to win.
You are getting an amen over here from Danny Samalas. Go ahead.
I totally agree. I mean, Jill brings up some great points. The defense has a difficult case here. They can't just point at Cohen and say, liar, liar, pants on fire,
right?
Because the state here has assembled evidence that corroborate what Cohen says. Cohen's lack of credibility may not be as big a problem as many, including me, originally thought, because there are going to be documents. And maybe the people's star witness isn't Michael Cohen. Maybe it's David Pecker.
Yeah.
Here are a couple of reasons why. Number one, they opened with him. They never would have opened with David Pecker if they weren't feeling comfortable about him as a witness.
Yeah.
He has less credibility problems than Michael Cohen. And also, he corroborates the documents and Cohen's testimony. In the end, David Pecker may be the state's star witness, not Michael Cohen, who really may just be sort of a sideshow when this is all said and done.
Well, when I come back, I want to ask you about that, because the other problem they're going to have going after Michael Cohen, he did the crimes for Trump. He did them for Trump. He didn't just on his own do something. Hold your fuck. We're going to come right back, and I'm going to come right back to you. Jill Winebanks, thank you very much. Adam and Danny are staying with me. I'm going right to you, Adam, when we come right back. Trump built his reputation on the back pages of the tabloids. Why the prosecution thinks its first witness, as we just mentioned, the aforementioned former publisher David Pecker, played a central role. The readout continues after this. I'm coming to you right after we come back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Today, jurors began hearing testimony from one of the most critical witnesses in Donald Trump's hush money election interference trial, David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer. He's at the heart of the alleged coordination between Michael Cohen and Trump to silence the stories of women who claimed to have had sexual relations with Trump in order to save his campaign. A longtime friend and ally of Trump, Pecker, has been cooperating with state and federal prosecutors in their investigations. Prosecutors say Pecker participated in an August 2015 meeting with Trump and Michael Cohen to discuss countering negative stories about Trump's relationships with women by buying exclusive rights to their stories and then never publishing them, a practice known as catch and kill. Pecker has been granted immunity in exchange for his testimony. And in 2018, the Inquirer's parent company, American Media, Inc., made a deal to avoid federal prosecution, acknowledging that it paid $150,000 to Playboy model Karen McDougal for her story about an alleged affair and held it until after the election. In October 2016, Pecker is alleged to have aided Trump yet again, brokering the deal that led to Michael Cohen's $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels. Pecker testified for less than 30 minutes today, but is expected to take the stand again tomorrow. In his brief time on the stand, Pecker explained how his former company conducted business. He told the court, quote, "We used checkbook journalism and we paid for stories. I gave a number to the editors that they could not spend more than $10,000 to investigate, produce, or publish a story." Joining me now is Christy Greenberg, former SDNY Criminal Division Deputy Chief and MSNBC legal analyst, who is in the courtroom today. And back with me are Adam Reese and Danny Savalos. Adam, I promise to come to you first.
Right. Well, David Pecker is going to take us right into this scheme, the conspiracy. They gather at Trump Tower. You've got three players. Three co-conspirators, Donald Trump, David Pecker, and Michael Cohen. And the Access Hollywood tape comes out. The campaign is turned upside down. What are we going to do? They're on defense. So they hatch this plan. They meet at Trump Tower. They're going to do three things. They're going to catch and kill. Three stories. Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal, and this doorman who's got this story of Donald Trump fathering a child unwed, which apparently isn't true. That's number one. Number two, they're going to attack his opponents in the 2016 election, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio. And number three, they're going to promote good stories. Mm-hmm. We are hearing now from David Pecker right at the end of trial today. He's going into his emails. He's got two emails. He's got a number of telephones. We're going to start hearing these communications, texts, emails. It's the documentation, the checks. It's all of that that will back him up. And as Danny said, he could be as important a witness as Michael Cohen.
And so, Christy, well, thank you for being here. And so you were at SDNY. We were talking off. I'm going to bring our off the record conversation during the break online. I mean, the issue here is that Michael Cohen was prosecuted by the Southern District of New York, where you used to work. But the Southern District of New York could not prosecute Trump at the time, who was he was a part of the conspiracy. He's named in the Cohen indictment, right?
Individual one.
Individual one. But he was president, so he was untouchable at the time. To me, the problem the defense is going to have is explaining how what Cohen did is a crime, but he did it for individual one, but that person also isn't guilty of a crime.
Right. I mean, at Cohen's guilty plea, Cohen very clearly says, "I did this at the direction of and in coordination with Donald Trump." And it's so it is there in black and white. He's never backed away from that since his plea. He's been consistent with that. And so, yes, that piece, I think, is going to be really hard for them to deal with. And they honed in on this in the opening, the state. They were very clear who was the beneficiary.
Yeah.
Who was this at the direction of? The same words that Cohen used, you saw in the opening today, because it's a key point. The jury will very clearly use their common sense and understand that.
Everyone will understand, Danny, Michael Cohen isn't the one who had an affair with these women. So he had no reason to do it. There's no reason to take out a $130,000 second mortgage on your home that you then have to make up lies to the bank in order to qualify for it, because you wouldn't have qualified other than making up stuff on the form. So then you committed that secondary crime. What reason would he have to do that if he wasn't doing it for Trump and if Trump wasn't going to pay him back?
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a great example. If Michael Cohen had been an ultra rich friend of Donald Trump, and he could just reach into his pocket and pull out $130,000, then that might be a tougher argument to make. But what you're pointing out is Michael Cohen did this at great risk to himself, at great cost to himself, at great difficulty. Imagine for anybody going and getting a mortgage for the purpose of paying hush money. That is not something that you would do unless you had some tremendous benefit from that. And for Michael Cohen, there was none. The only person benefiting was Donald Trump. So I think the state is going to benefit from that. In addition, they have corroboration. I mean, we've spent so much time talking about Michael Cohen being not credible. I don't know that it matters all that much. It doesn't matter because they have David Pecker. They have the documents. We've seen the documents since at least 2017, 2018. The checks with Donald Trump's signature on them. All of those records are going to come in, and the jury, as I think juries often do, I think they understand that cooperating witness types are not perfect. And there's even a rap that prosecutors will do in their closing. It's going to sound something like, we didn't choose this witness,
Trump
Michael
did.
Cohen, we didn't choose him. Trump did. That's who Trump did business with. That's who we had to bring in here to tell you the story.
Yeah.
So look, right, so far, prosecution 101, they're following the playbook.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
Let's talk about how the jury, you guys were in the courtroom, what the demeanor of the jury, you were talking a little bit about that. How were they reacting to the things they were hearing, both from David Pecker and from the prosecution and the defense?
So I was very keen on when the prosecutor was talking through the Access Hollywood tape and the language there. And I didn't see anybody flinch. There was no visible reaction to that language. There was a visible reaction when both sides were talking about how frugal Donald Trump was. At least one juror smiled and kind of, you know, like rolled her eyes a little bit. Like there were reactions to that, but otherwise it was tough to read them.
Yeah.
It was day one. It was a short day. They were listening intently and they were actually taking copious notes.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to see as it goes on. There'll be some witnesses that aren't as exciting as David Pecker.
Yeah.
But for today, they were listening intently.
What do you all expect to hear? Because David Pecker is going to testify in greater, because today was Passover, so obviously they had a shorter day. What do you all expect to hear from David Pecker? What do you think more he will bring to the table?
I think David Pecker is a great witness for the people because he's going to describe a scheme. In other words, this will not be a case where we're looking at one or two or really the transactions that are in the indictment in isolation. David Pecker is going to set the stage. He's going to take us back to the beginning. In the beginning, there was a meeting. And in that meeting, we talked about our catch and kill thing that we did. And notice that even in his opening testimony, David Pecker described what he called checkbook journalism.
Mm-hmm.
That actually is at odds with what Trump's defense counsel said in his opening, which was to portray this as, well, look, the Inquirer does what it does. We don't have any control over their editorial capacity or what they do. So instead, David Pecker is going to really describe the culture of what his business did and what he did through his relationship with Michael Cohen, with Donald Trump. And remember, they were friends. He may have information that we don't even know about yet through that friendship.
Yeah.
So again, David Pecker is at the lead, and I think that's for a reason.
Yeah.
The people feel comfortable with them. They feel like they can come out of the gate with a bang, and I think that's what they're going to do.
And he'll tell the full truth. He already cut a deal. Let's talk about Donald Trump's demeanor a little bit. Because Donald Trump, you know, I find it interesting that the defense opened by talking about him being a family man when his family wasn't there. What was the reaction of him to hearing this sort of being lauded as a family man? And did the jury react to the fact that his family wasn't? Did they seem to react?
The jury has been listening all along and they react at certain points. But in terms of his demeanor, leading up, we had a week of jury selection and he was closing his eyes. We need to be very careful to say whether or not he was sleeping.
Meditating,
but
his
eyes were shut tightly.
Yeah.
Today, he was pretty wide awake and very aware and very interested. He looked straightforward during the prosecution's open, but he listened intently as Todd Blanche gave his. And he's been listening to David Pecker, looking at him. David Pecker's actually looking at him, too. David Pecker's directing his comments to the jury. So Donald Trump's involved, but, you know, he's also a little bit uninvolved and just sort of not caring much.
Yeah.
This is going to go on for a while, and it's going to be interesting to see how he sort of acts. Is he going to act out? It's going to be 6 weeks.
Because he's losing his mind as soon as he gets back to his Truth Social toy.
Yeah. So one thing when you said, how does it play that Melania and the family are not there? Well, the defense argument is that these hush money payments were made to protect him, to protect his family, and to protect the brand, not the campaign. If it's for the campaign, that's what makes it an illegal campaign contribution.
Right.
So that matters. So the fact that they are not there, how much was this really about anything other than the campaign? And that's why David Pecker is so important, because he's going to say, we had this meeting, Michael Cohen, Donald Trump, who called the meeting. We learned today Donald Trump called that meeting with the three of them, and they all talked about the fact that this was on the eyes and ears of the campaign.
Yeah.
I want to protect anything from hurting the campaign. It was very clear that we were killing these stories because we didn't want it to affect the election. And then it worked, because after the election, there's this thank you dinner, and he invites them to the White House.
Yeah.
We're going to hear all about that. So, and the one key point that they also said was, after the election, Donald Trump didn't care if they were released from these NDAs. It was Dino the doorman.
Yeah.
Didn't care. Like, after the election, oh,
care.
Okay, we don't care.
You
go ahead, talk.
It.
And you hear that on the audio recording as well, where he's saying, like, can't we just delay the payment? Just delay it.
Right.
Like, yeah, because after the election, it didn't matter.
Didn't matter.
It had nothing to do with his family. It had everything to do with the election.
I hope that they show Michael Cohen's campaign email. I feel like I'm not a lawyer, but I feel like that's what I would do. I would just be like, look, get a campaign email. Why would this guy who's the personal lawyer for the president have a campaign email? Make it make sense. Christy Greenberg, Adam Reese, Danny Savalos, thank you all very much. Up next on The Readout, the Tim O'Brien joins me on how this trial is the reality show Trump never, ever wanted. Stay with us.
It's Monday, everyone. Happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back to back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC. Monday night.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Donald Trump fled New York City because it was a city that never really loved him, either personally or politically. As a criminal defendant, Trump is required to sit in a New York courtroom and listen to regular New Yorkers call him selfish and self-serving or a racist, sexist, narcissist. For half the country, that is not news. But it is a thing that Trump avoids. He lives his life in a hermetically sealed Mar-a-Lago bubble where people cheer his every move and affirm every ridiculous idea that he burps out. Faced with the unvarnished truth, Trump is the emperor with no clothes, feckless, feeble, and incoherently untethered to reality, at least when he's awake. Joining me now is Tim O'Brien, senior executive editor at Bloomberg Opinion and MSNBC political analyst. I'm glad that you were here, Tim, because it does seem to me that this is the shrinking of Donald Trump. I mean, his legend is kind of hard to keep up with when jurors are saying he's just a regular guy and he's sitting there falling asleep like your average senior citizen.
Yeah, and I think he's painfully and visibly aware of it. And I think right now today at least, I was in the courtroom and he kept it under wraps.
Did he make eye contact with you?
Oh, you know, I was in the overflow.
Oh, okay,
room.
Okay.
In the main courtroom.
Gotcha.
But he was sending me his hate beam to the TV screen. He's profoundly aware that he's not in control of the narrative.
Yeah.
And he's a media addict, and he is someone who's spent his whole life myth-making.
Yeah.
And laying down these legends about his success as a businessman, and as a lover, and as a student,
yeah.
and as an athlete, and as a politician. And all of that in different ways are being put in play in this court proceeding.
Let me play a moment that we were talking about it during the commercial break. I wanted to play it, and it's where a reporter asked where his wife was. Here it is.
Where's Melania?
Where is Melania?
She's not with him. That's all we can say for certain. But, you know, I had dinner with Donald and Melania in Mar-a-Lago in 2005. And they were...
That's a year before the Stormy Daniels alleged.
Yeah. And they were very affectionate, legitimately fond of one another, playful, affectionate. He took great pride in her.
Mm-hmm.
I think she loved everything that he brought into her life.
Mm-hmm.
I think she also clearly knew the deal she was making when she hooked up with him. To see the two of them now, and Trump in particular, just the complete sort of emotional and moral degradation. Not that Donald Trump walked into it in 2005 as like a model of virtue.
Sure.
But he's, you know, he is visibly altered physically. He's aged severely over the last 4 years. And I think she made her deal with the devil.
Yeah.
And
she knows what she's doing. She knows exactly what she's
doing. But the fact that she's gotten to a place where she's not even going to show up in court.
Yeah. And it would help him a lot if she was there.
A lot.
Let me play this moment, which is, of course, the moment that allegedly triggered the hush money payment, the sort of emergency hush money payment to Stormy Daniels. Here it is.
I better use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the I can do anything.
Donald Trump's lawyer, Mr. Blanch, said he's a man, he's a husband, he's a father just like me. When that was read, they're not playing the video, but they're reading those words. I don't see how any juror thinks that's a man, a father, a husband, someone just like me.
And I think the prosecution will have a field day testing that idea.
Yeah.
You know, Trump said last week, I'm being gagged in this courtroom. I can't leave. I can't even go to my son's graduation. Mm. I can't see my son graduate from high school. Mm. Well, let's remember that 4 months after his son was born is when he allegedly began his affair with Stormy Daniels.
Yeah.
So the, you know, the great loving father who can't leave the court to see his son graduate is, has no problem fooling around behind his wife's back shortly after his son is born.
Let me put up the list of we know who's going to testify: Michael Cohen, Stormy Daniels, Karen McDougal, David Pecker is going to be more of him tomorrow, Deborah Tarasoff, who worked for Trump. We just go down the list here. Hope Hicks, who was one of his close aides. Who do you think he's worried most about hearing from, or he'll be most uncomfortable listening to?
You know, I think he is worried about all of them, which is why I think he so desperately tried to put the brakes on this. I think David Pecker is a fact witness to the conspiracy that gives weight to the idea that they were setting out to ultimately affect the election results.
Yeah.
Hope Hicks was in that timeline, but she was an apologist for him.
Yeah.
She was, I don't know that she knew what the truth was, but she certainly wasn't telling it.
But she knew that the campaign, where the campaign stood. And it seems that that's what they want from her, right, is to talk about the state of the campaign. I mean, at one point, Republicans were talking about dropping him as the candidate after the Access Hollywood tape.
Right. And remember during that moment, it's when he's in Trump Tower and he's looking down the street and there's all these pro-MAGA people saying, "We love you." And he says to Jared, "I'm going to go down the street and talk to them." And Jared said, you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually been the moment when Trump realized he had this superpower within the party to go beyond the party elders.
Yeah.
But I think that Pecker, I was anticipating his testimony today. It got cut short.
Yeah.
But I'm going to be there tomorrow to watch it because I think it could be unraveling for Trump.
We shall see. Tim O'Brien, thank you very much. And coming up, Columbia University switched to remote learning today as student protests over the war in Gaza enter a sixth day and spread to campuses across the nation. The readout continues after this. Passover begins at sundown tonight, and it will be an emotional ritual for many Jews this year amid the continuing captivity of Israeli hostages. Meanwhile, massive protests for a free Palestine have been unfolding on the campus of Columbia University, where tensions have exploded over the protests and allegations of anti-Semitism. The New York Police Department has built up a large presence around Columbia, and Columbia's president, Nemat Minush Shafik, has shifted the campus to remote learning following a weekend of demonstrations. More than 100 people were arrested over the last several days after the university asked police to break up a tent encampment students had set up on its south lawn in support of Gaza. The students who were arrested were peaceful and did not resist. They erected dozens of tents on a campus lawn last week and refused to leave until Columbia met their demands, including divesting from companies with ties to Israel. Students on campuses across this country have created encampments in solidarity with those arrested, including at MIT, Yale, New York University, and the New School. At the crux of these on-campus tensions are allegations of anti-Semitism hurled against Jewish students, or accusations that Columbia's leadership has not done enough to keep students safe. A dueling narrative has emerged, with student protesters saying the anti-Semitism is not coming from Columbia students. Joining me now is the Reverend Mark Thompson, a social justice activist and host of the Make It Plain podcast, and Mariam Alwan, a Columbia student who helped organize the pro-Palestinian protest and was suspended and arrested. She's also an organizer of Columbia University's Students for Justice in Palestine chapter. Thank you both for being here. I do want to start with you, Mariam, because people are equating the protest that you are one of the leaders of with the people who were screaming at Jewish students just off campus. Are these two groups connected?
No, I think that with every social movement, there are unfortunately outside detractors who come and try to spread their hateful rhetoric, and we stand completely against this. It's horrifying to see, but we stand for liberation and human rights and equality for Jewish people, for Palestinians, and that's what we're calling for.
I mean, I saw, Mark, these students singing and singing about peace and singing salam, you know, singing words of peace. So it just didn't square with what I was even hearing on television and television commentators saying was shrieking anti-Semitism. I didn't hear it.
No, I was there yesterday, and it was very peaceful and very moving. The one of the institutions affiliated with Columbia, of course, is Union Theological Seminary, and the Union students held a Sunday worship service and served communion there on the campus, even to those beyond the gates who couldn't get in. So this betrays the imagery of there being violent rhetoric spewed. I will say this. I do have a colleague whose daughter is a freshman at Barnard, and she has faced some harassment. But as Mariam said, these are outliers. And in the movement, we've always had a
It happened at Black Lives Matter rally.
Yeah, you've got provocateurs.
Yeah.
So that's, but in general, it's not a good idea to generalize what's going on. These are peaceful and nonviolent demonstrations.
Let me, what do you make of the leaders of your school seeming, I guess, to appease maybe members of Congress that have been all over your president and wanted to resign, calling the NYPD on you all?
It feels like it's been a McCarthyite campaign to try to equate our peaceful protest calling for them to divest from violence, and then they're calling us violent instead. It was absolutely horrifying to be carried out in zip ties when we were, you know, just peacefully calling for an end to the violence.
Let me play Ilhan Omar's daughter, Irsa Hirsi, was on with with my good friend Ayman Mohedin over the weekend. This is what she said. You guys were on together. Yeah.
I think that the encampment was honestly one of the beautiful forms of solidarity. We would be singing songs. We had meals together. People prayed together. They held Shabbat yesterday. And it's really just been a very community-centered space. And also because of the fact that it is outside, it hadn't disrupted any classes and had really been a very isolated kind of moment where the zone in which we were actually protesting in is the demonstration zone that we are allowed to technically be able to protest in.
We're charged with trespassing. I mean, it's about $60,000 a year to attend that school, but you're considered trespassers.
Yeah, and ironically, they should have suspended us in order to say that we were trespassing, but they didn't. And then when we were suspended, they said that we were suspended because we were arrested. So
you all are suspended from school?
Yes, as well, yeah.
There is a history of this school calling the police on protesters, but these were Black protesters back when they were building the gym.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1968.
Yeah.
Same thing. And honestly, you know, it looks like we're headed back there. What happened in 1968? Democratic Convention in Chicago, and people were protesting the Vietnam War. Here we are again protesting a war, and what the well-paid consultant class doesn't seem to be able to get over to the White House is that he's very much looking like LBJ at this moment. And if the White House isn't careful, they're going to hand this election over to the BB of America, which is Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But I'm very proud of these students. They remind us of all the things we used to do. We went yesterday as clergy, myself, Reverend Stephen Green, Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, and we prayed, we shared communion. And so we can do two things at once, Joy.
Yeah.
We can say happy Passover to our Jewish sisters and brothers.
Absolutely.
And also fight for justice.
And there were Jewish students that are protesting with you.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
So what do you make of the fact that your protest, just calling for even ceasefire at this point, is being equated with anti-Semitism?
It's very sad. It's a smear campaign that we've been dealing with for a long time now. And I feel like I think it's because our institutions and our government are so invested in these violent, you know, companies that they will do whatever it takes to blacklist us.
What do you want as students? What is your group asking for?
So we're asking that our school divest from all funds that are profiting off of apartheid and genocide, as well as amnesty for all students and faculty that have been subject to this McCarthyite campaign and discipline. And we also want transparency about what Columbia is investing in the first place.
You know, I recall, you know, just from memory and from reading that the Vietnam War protests, when they were suppressed, including at Kent State violently,
right,
they actually just spread.
That's right.
And it seems like the same thing is happening here. The more that the clampdown happens on these students standing up for Palestinians in Gaza, the more it spreads.
NYU, MIT, Yale, just in the past 24 hours. And now the word's gotten out that President Biden's going to speak at Morehouse. We can expect demonstrations at HBCUs as well.
And do you think that Why do you think that there seems to be more fear of this movement? I mean, during the Trump administration, there were actual massacres.
Yes.
At, you know, Jewish institutions, a couple of major massacres. There seems to be more alarm about these students than about that atmosphere Donald Trump has created, equating, you know, pulling Nazi themes back into the discourse.
I honestly agree with Richard Haass of the Council on Foreign Relations, who's been coming on Morning Joe every morning saying BB is running against Biden.
Yeah.
This is an election year. There's some politics in this. So it's not just about what's going on over there. They want to impact the election here and have the nexus of BB, Trump, and Putin in power.
Well, I can say young people standing up for their principles, I think, is a good thing. Thank you very much, Mariam Alwan. Stay safe. Mark Thompson, my friend. Thank you very much. We'll be right back. That is tonight's readout.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.